launch system, and they'll be able to launch out from Launch Complex 39B. 39A has been taken over by SpaceX. When all the Saturn rockets were going off, you had two complexes. You had the Launch Complex 39A and Launch Complex 39B. And then those complexes eventually were turned into space shuttle launch complexes after Apollo was done. Now they still kept the launch complexes, but one is turned over to SpaceX for the Falcon 9, and the other one is turned over to the Space Launch System for NASA, for the Orion spacecraft. So I'll be looking for that launch. Of course, it's suborbital, but it should be a very interesting test this coming April. So that's one topic. Another topic is a launch this coming this week, actually Thursday. Yeah, March 14th, 3:14 p.m. or Eastern Time, 3:14 Eastern Standard Time. They'll be launching a Soyuz rocket up to the International Space Station with three people on board. And the three people are going to be Nick Hague, Christine Koch, and Alex Obergin. By the way, the launch time is weird. It's launching up on Thursday, which is March 14th. And some people call that Pi Day. Pi Day because it's March is the third month, and it's on the 14th. But the time they're going to be launching for, well, for Eastern Standard Time anyway, is 3:14 p.m. You know, they're launching from Kazakhstan, which is on the other side of the globe. It won't be 3:14 p.m. there, but here it will. So it's actually going off on Pi Day and Pi Time. So these three people to be launched to the space station are two Americans and one Russian. If people follow this net on a regular basis, Nick Hague and Alex and the Obergin, the Russian, might be familiar because last year, just the two of them were launched on a Soyuz spacecraft. They were supposed to go up to the International Space Station. They were not taking three at the time, just the two. And, well, they didn't make it. They got, became a suborbital flight. That flight was aborted because one of the boosters, they have four boosters attached to the Soyuz. One of the boosters, when it separated, came back and hit the core of the spacecraft, and therefore causing an abort. They were pretty lucky to survive that. What happened was, instead of the tractor system similar to the launch abort system that would be on Orion, launch abort system would have pulled the spacecraft, the Soyuz, away from the Soyuz rocket. What happened was the timing was such that the jettison rocket for the whole tractor launch abort system was pulled away. It was time for that to happen. And that just leaves spacecraft with the fairing surrounding it. Well, the Russians also have a secondary system connected to the fairings. They had these abort motors is attached to the fairings themselves. So since the fairings didn't separate yet, that's the motors that came on that pulled the Soyuz spacecraft safely away from the booster as the booster came crashing back down to Earth. So NASA and Roscosmos decided, well, let's give these two guys another shot. And there was one other launch recently that sent a crew up there. That's up there now. They have three people up there now. And then these two are getting another shot to launch this Thursday. And they needed a third person. In this case, they're going to launch three people. So they got a hold of Christina Koch, woman astronaut, to fly with them. It will be her first flight up, and she will be join three other people on board. You have Oleg Kononenko. He's the other Russian on board the space station now. You have the fellow from Canada, David St. Jacques. He's up there right now. And she'll be joining Anne McLean. Right now she is the only American on board the International Space Station. So what they're going to have is six people. And they happen to have a scheduled, they actually have three scheduled EVAs coming up. But one of them, I believe on the 29th of this month, it's going to be, they're going to send out two women. They'll be sending out Anne McLean and Christina Koch. It'll be the first time two women do an EVA together with no other guys. It's always been, anytime a woman has done an EVA, they've done a lot of them. I believe Peggy Whitson has done like eight different EBAs, but anytime they've gone out, it's always been with another guy. So this happens to be March is Women's Month, so it just happens to work out like this. They didn't plan it, but that's what they're doing. What they are actually going to be doing is they call it maintenance work. They're going to be changing out these batteries. Now, International Space Station has plenty of batteries, like 48 of these monstrous batteries, each one weighing a couple hundred pounds. So there's, collectively, it's about 12,000, no, actually more than that, about 18,000 pounds worth of batteries and equipment mounted to the outside of the International Space Station. What happens is the solar panels are up there. They deliver enough power to keep the space station going, but at the same time they're also charging these massive batteries. And the ones that are up there now are called nickel hydrogen batteries. It's an older design, and over time they plan on changing out all of these. So far they've done 25% of them. They've done that on previous space walks a couple of years ago, and they successfully did that. Every time you see these solar panels, they're grouped, and there's really like four groupings of solar panels, and each one has, you know, when they meet at the truss section, at the center of the truss section of each group, you have this set up with all these batteries. Their goal is to go over there and change them out. There's a bunch of new batteries sitting up there that were delivered actually over a year ago. They were delivered by the Japanese cargo vehicle, the HTV cargo vehicle, and the robotic arm attached all these batteries to a platform, and they're just sitting there waiting to be installed. The old ones are coming out, the nickel hydrogen ones are coming out, and eventually they'll be put onto one of these cargo vehicles, and they will burn up over the Pacific Ocean. The new ones are all lithium ion batteries, so they're about half the weight and a little smaller in size, and but most importantly they're able to last a lot longer. The ones that are up there last like 15, 16 years. But you know that's the end of their time frame, so that's why they're sending these new ones up. And as time went on, they developed these lithium ions to replace these. Like I said, they're lighter, they have more amp hours, and it will be better overall for the life of the International Space Station. So that will be Anne McLean and Christina Koch's job when they do that. Now, there's two other spacewalks involved. I think the batteries might also be involved in that as well. So let me drop it. This is WS2N. And some people have asked, on the internet, I read that people were wondering who the first woman was to do a spacewalk. And in our case, it's, you know, the United States, we were a little bit behind the Russian, but Catherine Sullivan was the first. They call it KT, if you ever saw the earlier launches by the shuttle back in the 80s. The other crew members referred to her as KT, and she was the first one to do that. Naturally, it wasn't the space station. It was 1984 before the space station was even built. So KT eventually became famous, more famous for the science community when she came back to Earth, because they eventually put her in charge of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She did that for quite a few years. Actually, until 2017, she actually resigned the first day the new administration took over. She bailed out. The first woman actually to go up into space was Valentina Tereshkova, but she didn't do a spacewalk. Another Russian woman did a couple of years later. So that's the story on that. Let me drop it and see if anybody has any comments or questions. Okay. As anybody that's following the space program knows, the Crew Dragon demo mission has now come back to Earth successfully. We followed this last week. It was only a six-day mission. And the idea of the mission was to fly a crew vehicle up to the International Space Station, dock with it, stay there for about 5 or 6 days, and then return safely without burning up to the ocean, ocean landing, in this case the Atlantic Ocean. And that's exactly what they did. They went up there, they docked successfully. On board they brought up about 400 pounds worth of stuff. It was kind of like ballast that they needed to duplicate a little bit more weight for a crew. And at the same time, it was needed supplies for the crew on board the space station. But on board, they had four seats sitting there as if somebody could be sitting in there. And in fact, they had one mannequin there, and all dressed in a spacesuit, just sitting there. And they named the mannequin Ripley. And they have all kinds of test equipment all over the mannequin to test the amount of G's, the heat, and all that. You know, everything they need to know. But one of the other items that you saw on the demo one vehicle, sitting in another seat, was this little stuffed animal. It looked like a stuffed animal. It was blue, but it was a representation of Earth, and they put two little ears, 2 feet on there, and face, two eyes, and nose. And what they actually do is they call it the zero G indicator. If you watch a lot of the Soyuz launches, or every single Soyuz launch, they always have some kind of a stuffed animal or something hanging on a string in the Soyuz spacecraft. So when they're going uphill, you see this thing hanging suspended, and then when the separation takes place with the, you know, from the boosters, you can see the stuffed animal start floating around, and it actually has a purpose. You know, like I mentioned, this last crew that went up there with Hag, when they aborted, one of the things that Moscow noted. Or noticed when they were going up that their zero G indicator wasn't doing what it was supposed to do, so they knew they were in trouble. Outside, of course, the telemetry. So this zero G indicator was on a little tether, and you could barely even see it. After a while, I noticed that I could see it, and it would only float around near the chair. So this is the American version of the zero G indicator. After they got up there, and Ann McLean, the American astronaut, went inside Dragon. You know, she made a little speech, you know, dedication to the a new crew vehicle, and she took this little stuffed animal inside the International Space Station. You know, when she floated back in, she took that with her. And it turns out that they liked this thing, and they kept bringing it to different parts of the space station. They brought it to the lounge area. They brought it to the medical area. They brought it to the quest lab where the spacesuits are, and they were dressing this thing up in different things, and it became a little stuffed animal pet for the crew. They brought it to do with it, and you would give it to them, and they would fly it to places, you know, and you could fly it to China and, you know, go by the Great Wall of China, or you could bring it to France and take a picture of it with the Eiffel Tower, you know. That's what this reminded me of, because the crew was taking this thing all over. They even brought it into the Soyuz spacecraft, the one that they used for returning to Earth. So SpaceX was expecting, of course, this thing is going to come back, you know, after they undock. Well, they undocked successfully the other day, and they made it all the way back to Earth, and they had four parachutes come out after using the heat shield, and they successfully landed in the water, and they had a SpaceX has their own ship. It's called Ghost Searcher. Ghost Searcher has this ship that goes up right up to the spacecraft and has this hydraulic lift that pulls the spacecraft on board the ship. But lo and behold, by the time they opened the door, Earthy, by the way, that's the name they gave it, Earthy was not there. So the story goes that the Earthy has been kidnapped, and it's true. They show it in the cupola. The cupola is the, you know, six windows that are inside the space station looking down at Earth, and it's sitting in a cupola looking down, and it's telling Earthy, yeah, there's your mother planet Earth down below. So I thought that was a good story. This is WS2N. Any comments?
Oh, I saw a video, I don't know if it was a YouTube video, of the four parachutes coming out with a very interesting sequence of a drogue chute at first, and then the four parachutes coming out almost completely collapsed, and then the air opening input at the bottom of the parachute slowly opened up, and then the spacecraft, the nose cone, so to speak, came all the way down to the water. I never did see a heat shield on that thing. I mean, in the case of Apollo, the command module, when it comes back, the heat shield does most of the deorbiting, if you know what I mean, and the blunt end gets aimed forward. And on that white object, I didn't see a heat shield, but maybe it was because the shrouding on the side was covering it up. Over to you, Paul, KQLIW.
Yeah, they have. They probably separated it at some point. That's my guess. I'll have to look at the pictures. In case of let's say the spacecraft goes off track. It's designed to go into the water right now. Let's say it goes off track and decides it wants to land on land. You got a crew in there. You're not going to have the water to soften your blow. So they said that they were going to have some kind of retro rockets eventually put into this thing. My guess is that, I'll have to check, I'm not sure yet, but my guess is they separated the heat shield as a test, because the thing's going to come down on land, they're going to want to fire those retros. Maybe they even did above the water, I don't know. We'll have to look further into that, Dick. But that's part of the plan. You know, Boeing is building a crewed vehicle that's going to be going up also in about April without a crew. And their system is designed to land on land. This one right now is designed to land on water. I have a picture of it up now, but I can't zoom in that close, Dick, so I can't really tell. I'll research that. That's my guess. That's what happened. When the Soyuz returns, they have a drogue satellite, hydraulic parachute come out, and then they pull out the main, and they just come down on one big parachute. And but before they get anywhere near the water, like a mile up, the heat shield separates, and when they come down and land on land, which is, you know, pretty much all the time in Kazakhstan, right before they land, there's four retro rockets that fire right before they hit the ground. So my guess is SpaceX is probably emulating that. But we'll look further into it. Boeing, again, has the capability of launching four people up. They'll be sending their uncrewed vehicle for a test very similar to this one to the space station, probably at end of April. Now we'll be launching on not a Falcon 9, but on a United Launch Alliance Atlas V on the top of that. And they have a service module, and they have a spacecraft called the Starliner. And it will be flying in a new configuration, the Atlas will. Anyway, Atlas usually flies with designations like, you know, 4-1-1 or 4-1, numbers like that. What they mean is the first number 4, sometimes it's the 5, is the diameter of the fairing that goes around there, whatever spacecraft they're sending up. And then the second number is how many solid boosters they're sending up. And then the last number is how many rockets are on the second stage. And it's always been one rocket on the second stage. It's always been a Centaur rocket. It's a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket. But in this case, they're going to be sending two up to the... for the crew mission, they need a little bit more power, and they need the power to last longer to get the heavier vehicle to the space station. So it's the first time they're sending up the Atlas V in a configuration called N, as in November 22. N stands for no fairing whatsoever. It's just a crew vehicle. Can't have a fairing around it, because if you have it aboard sitting out on a launch pad, or as you're flying up to the space station, you can't have a fairing there. You need to have the Boeing spacecraft pull itself away from the booster. So it'll be N for an N22, which is no fairing, two standing for two solid boosters that will be attached to this thing. And also another two, which means they're going to have two Centaur A-10 liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen attached to the second stage. So that should be an interesting configuration. Can't wait to see that go up, hopefully in April. You know, sounds good to me. Any comments or questions?
I'm going to back up one subject, or two subjects, Paul. Under normal circumstances, when you've got batteries on a solar voltaic system, during the time when a cloud comes over your house, you use the batteries, if you know what I mean, so you've got continuous power. In the case of the International Space Station, 17,500 miles an hour, you make one loop around the Earth every 90 minutes. What's not obvious at first is that you spend 45 minutes in the sunlight and 45 minutes in complete darkness on the backside of the Earth, so to speak, on every single orbit, 16 orbits per day. So those batteries are being charged for 45 minutes and discharged for 45 minutes. That cycle is repeated 16 times every single day. Those batteries are really working continuously. I'm amazed they can last that long.
Of you,
Paul,
K2LIW. Yeah, let's hope the new batteries actually built by Japan do as good as the old ones. The old ones were nickel hydrogen, is what they call them, nickel hydrogen batteries. they've had a really good past for other spacecraft, so they were dependable. They knew they were going to be good, but now, of course, they have lithium-ion ones, which have been built, like I said, by Japan. Yeah, every 16 times a day. That's exactly right. But there's 48 of these things, so you know whether or not they use all the power up. They charge. Depends on how much they use. They say they have more power up there than they know what to do with. In fact, when they work on this, they shut the whole line off. There's four separate lines. They're located either on the P4 structure or the P6 structure. And that they have these truss structures. There's 11 of them. You know, there's one in the middle, and then there's five that go out one way, and five go out the other way. And like going out to the port side, they'll have P3, P4, P6, and that type of thing. Well, on P4 and P6, they have these battery banks, that's what they use. And there's also the exact same setup on the starboard side. S4 and S6.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I forgot how many amp hours. Tremendous amount of amp hours. But you can imagine, these batteries were like over 300 pounds. The new ones, all the ones were over 400 pounds. And each battery, they said, is about the size of a good-sized suitcase. I think it's 3 foot by 3 foot by 1 foot, or 3 foot by 3 foot by 1.5 feet. So they're pretty big. And they kind of like plug into the base. You know, they'll pull out the old ones, put in the new ones, and they have to bolt them down. And a lot of the work is being done by the robotic arm. Dexter is the robot that's attached to the robot arm. And that's already been done, where they loosen up all the bolts and everything. And then it's up to the crew to maneuver these batteries, take out the old ones and put them on a pallet, a storage pallet, and then take the new batteries that's on the storage pallet that were brought up already, probably over a year ago, and attach them to the proper location. So one group was done. I think it took around two or three spacewalks. The next group, and that means probably another year or so from now, they'll do another group and then another one to complete the whole setup. Now, one time they had problems with ammonia leaks in the radiator system, so they shut a whole section down. So they were actually only operating on 75% capability. And they did this for like a couple of years, you know, and thought nothing of it. And they still have more power to do whatever they need. They said if when everything's running, they have the equivalent of running 40 homes, 40 Earth homes, you know, homes on Earth. So when the shuttle's docked, and now the same thing with Dragon now, when these vehicles come up and they dock to the space station, they're going to get recharged by the solar panels on board, and they got more power on that than they know what to do with. So as you dock, a couple of connections get made automatically, and that's how they're going to do that. And that's why each vehicle is going to be able to stay. I think they're roughly around 250 days, I'm off by a few days. Roughly around 250 days per year. So you go up, you'll stay on board the space station for 6 months, and then you'll go back on the same vehicle. And that's the way it works. And then another vehicle comes up and replaces you. Now, because Dragon and Starliner by Boeing can carry four people at one time, eventually you're going to have a regular contingency, a crew, on the International Space Station of seven people instead of six. You know, right now we have right now three. Now once Christina Koch and Haig and Alexander Ochin, the Russians go up there, there'll be six people on board. As this Dragon and Starliner by Boeing eventually, you know, start becoming regular trips to the space station, you're going to have, seven people up there. And they said that they will be able to double the amount of science time that goes into the space station. So, by just having one extra person join the crew on a full-time basis. Any other comments or questions? This is WS2M.
Those batteries that they're going to be changing out, removing the old ones, putting the new ones in, and they've got some kind of a fancy connector, and they bolt them down. I'm guessing all of those bolts are captured bolts, and the wrench that they use to turn those bolts, I'll bet you that's not a ratchet wrench. I'll bet you that's a motorized wrench of some kind, with a carefully calibrated torque reading to it. Is that true, Paul? K2LIW?
I haven't seen a close-up of the setup. I'm sure each one is attached and can't fall off, you know. And once it catches, you'll be able to make it up. Now, they won't have to do that. They're going to be installing them. But the robot, the Dexter robot that's attached, that they can attach to the end of the 57-foot Canadian robot arm, is the gadget that does it. You know, it goes over there, it's got all kinds of tools attached to itself, and it will be able to tighten up all the connections of the bolts. I believe the astronauts actually do there are some connections, data connections and things that have to be attached to these things too. Each one is a battery setup, and each one has, some kind of voltage regulating system, and, they've got to be able to communicate with these batteries from the Destiny module. Each one has its own communication hookup. They have to hook that stuff up before they leave, go back inside. And it's going to be a long EVA. They said 7.5 hours, so they'll be out there a while. Back to you, Dick.
I vaguely remember that the consumables on board that backpack are only good for approximately 8 hours. Is that true, Paul?
Yeah, but then there's an emergency setup. I think it's 9 hours, they said now. But because of the safer pack that's on the back, it also has backup oxygen. And what they do is, if they have to, if they really plan on going longer, they've done it a couple of times where they will go back to they used to go back to the shuttle. In this case, they go back to Quest Lab. Quest Lab is the setup where the module where they leave from when they do EVAs, when the Americans do it anyway. The Russians have their own Pierce module that they leave from. But, the Americans can come back, and you can plug yourself in, and you can get more oxygen. You can last longer if you have to. But even if they plan for, let's say, 7 hours, they can go out for 7.5, 8 hours. And depending how it goes, sometimes they might even go back early if they do good, or they start doing get-ahead tests. So I'll have to see what they do. A lot of these are long, long spacewalks. They do 7 hours on a regular basis.
I think the longest one ever was, though, was Story Musgrave, when he did his first repair on Hubble. He really pushed it. He used the full backpack, the emergency backpack, and I think that was running out while he was in the airlock coming back into the shuttle. And he had to plug into the emergency line that's in the airlock as the airlock was being pressurized. He went to the absolute edge, as I remember. I think we read somewhere in the last week or so that Hubble has had a partial failure of one of its cameras. Is that still in the failure mode, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
I haven't heard that it came back on yet. That's the ACS camera, the advanced camera for survey. Apparently failed on them. And now they're looking to see what they can get out of it. They said they didn't have any science missions for the ACS, the advanced camera for survey, presently anyway, so it happened to be a good time when it went out. They're using the other one, the wide field camera. It used to be called the wide field planetary camera. I still call it that, but now they officially they call it the wide field camera. And that was the last one that quit working on them. And they got some voltage readings that were, you know, wrong, and they weren't too sure what was going on there. And then apparently they figured out what that was, and they eventually got that one working again. This ACS one, they had problems. It was, you know, the Hubble was up in, what, 1990, around 2002 or so, the ACS quit working. And then it stayed out of business for like 5 years until one of the service missions went up. And that was the one where Massimino, he's a guy from New York, he had to get to the power supply for the ACS camera, and this handle was in the way, this part of the Hubble Space Telescope, and they tried everything to take apart this handle, and the bolts, I guess the bolts or whatever they were trying to take apart was stripped, and he just couldn't get it. So he got the bright idea, and he asked Mission Control, I just want to break the thing off, you know, bend it back or something. And he wiggled it back and forth, and eventually broke. He said later on, he was thinking, I hope I don't break the Hubble Space Telescope. And he got that handle, and they say he has that as a souvenir now or something. They gave him the handle that he bought back. But now they got the handle out. You know, by doing that, they were able to get to the box, replace the power supply for the ACS camera, and they put it into operation again. But apparently this thing is now failed again, like you said. So you don't know when they're going to get that back to work. Back to you, Jerry.
Are they absolutely positive there's not going to be another repair mission to Hubble? Are we going to let Hubble slowly grind itself all the way down, so to speak? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's the toast. I think next time you see anything go up there, it's going to be a spacecraft to dock with it. You know, the last mission, 2009, they attached a docking collar to it, hoping that maybe, you know, we had another spacecraft by now that we'd be able to bring a crew to do something, or maybe a robotic mission to try to save it. But presently, there's no plans on doing anything like that. But you never know. You know, let's see how good this thing goes. You know, maybe it'll stay up there, and they think eventually Dream Chaser would have that capability. The spacecraft that's being built that will eventually land like a shuttle, about 25% the size of a shuttle, but I mean it would be able to go up, and they think that would have the capability to fix something like that. So, yeah, that's the story on that. And you asked questions last week about the WFIRST telescope that's going to be launched in 2023. Maybe 2024, you know, the way things go. But that was originally planned to go to an L2 position a million miles out. And that changed a couple of years ago. And I knew it was an orbital mission. I found out last week it's a geosynchronous orbital mission. So it's going to be 23,000 miles out, but in a 28 degree inclination. So it's not going to be true, you know, geosynchronous orbit, you know, in geostationary orbit. It's going to be geosynchronous. And the idea is it's going to stay roughly in the same spot all the time and be able to transmit constantly back to Earth. But again, on that one, they're putting a docking collar, and they're going to have the capability to service this. But of course, at 23,000 miles out, that suspect. You know, right now anyway, you're not going to be able to put a crew out there. But they think a robotic mission could be possible, so that building everything as modular as possible on the W-1st mission. So let's say a power supply goes out, and you'll be able to send the spacecraft out to geosynchronous orbit, and some kind of robotic arm system will be able to pull the old setup out and plug in a new one, you know. So they're making it serviceable, although chances of a human being doing it, because getting him back from geosynchronous orbit would not be easy. Back to you, Dick.
From time to time, Paul, we've had a talk about them building some kind of a robot-like device that can go out there unmanned and do refueling and repair. Is anybody really working on that, or for some reason they're afraid to do that, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, they're working on it. They want to, there's one particular satellite they're actually going to try to save. I guess a proof of concept deal. But this idea has been going on for years. You know, I mentioned earlier Kathy Sullivan, KT, first woman American to do a spacewalk. On her spacewalk, she was out there. One of the jobs that they had was to see if you could pump hydrazine fuel from one tank to another, which was successfully done. You know, they wanted to see the capability, and that's back in the 80s, you know, and they wanted to see the capability of refueling, and it worked out, and they, you know, from there, they've done many other systems like that, including on the space station. They have setups on the outside of the space station that have successfully done that type of thing. So they're getting better at it, and it's a possibility in the future. I'm trying to think. I think it's the LSAT that they want to save. Let me drop it. Something called the Restore mission that's being built. Google Restore satellite. You get all kinds of information on this thing. That's eventually, not this year, but eventually going to go out and service the. It's a Lockheed Martin satellite that needs some kind of service. And if that works out, of course, then they'll go on from there. This one happens to be a couple hundred miles up, like 300 miles up. It's not geosynchronous, but, you know, start low and work your way up, I guess. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. Considering the number of repairs that have to be done and the number of refuelings and the number of spacecraft we get out there and the difficulty of putting a man out there with all his consumables, you would think we would have put a little more effort into a remotely operated, a robot-like object that can go out there and do these repairs. Yes, it's going to require some very good cameras and feedback and control from the ground, but I think it can be done. Okay, Paul, we're coming near the end. We've got 1 minute to go. That was, space report number 337. You may think it's 338. That was science talk number 66. And technet number 1737. Maybe 1738. Bye-bye, you all. Let's see if Roy has any further comments. And he's probably going to repeat his addresses by way of how you can get to Roy, and do send him some mailbag questions. AC2GS for any other comments. K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
I guess they'll be back. It's WS2N. Next week we'll catch up on the InSight mission, that probe that was going to dig itself into the ground. Didn't make it too far, Dick, so I think they got a problem.
Yes, I've heard they ran into a rock. It didn't go very far. And they're now going to sit back and study what's going on. They're going to turn on the heat machine, even though it's near the surface, and measure the thermal characteristics of the surface of Mars. So, 73 you all. See you next week. And back to Paul for any final. I think Roy, when he was running high power, I think he did mysteriously stop transmitting, and maybe he's got a repair to do. Over to you, Paul, for any final. KQRIW, clear but listening.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I'll be the toasted out. I toasted mine a while back. So I wound up with two new power supplies. So one of them I like is the Samlex one. It's got two meters on there and everything. So I finally joined the modern times. I got away from the 1980s with my old power supply. All right, so we'll be here next week. We'll see 73, and have a good rest of the week. And I plan on watching or listening to at least the launch of the next Soyuz Expedition 59 mission that will be going up to the space station on Thursday. And if, let's see, Thursday is the 14th, 15th, 16th. I guess next time back here will be St. Patrick's Day. 73, WS2N clear.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel. Tonight at 8:30.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link here.
Repeater, timeout. 12:04 a.m. 73. And good night from the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Tonight at 8:30, W2VL repeater system. Tonight at 8:30, welcome to the W2VL repeater. W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.